This morning we're beginning the third chapter of Daniel. We'll be looking at the first 18 verses. I've taken those 18 verses and divided it into four sections. If you have an outline there, you will see. First section is the first seven verses. Second section is verses 8 to 12. The third, verses 13 to 16. And then the last one, verses 17 and 18. And in each one of those sections, I want to kind of hone in on one phrase that we want to make a point about in the context of those verses and as we go through it. So let's begin with the first section, the first seven verses of Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 80 cubits, or your versions may say 90 feet tall, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So we see here that Nebuchadnezzar has made an image. The word image includes the likeness. This is not just some arbitrary statue, but it's some type of image that is a likeness of something or someone. Now, perhaps it's Nebuchadnezzar. We don't know. The height to breadth ratio of this statue is 10 to 1, 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide. 10 to 1 ratio for a person if this is Nebuchadnezzar, which I suspect that it is, but it's a skinny Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know very many people whose height to breadth ratio is 10 to 1. Mine's more like 1 to 1. All right. But he makes this statue. It perhaps looks more like, you know, one of these satellite towers around here. 90 feet tall is like a 9 or 10 story building. So he makes this statue, sets it up in the plain. I don't know if that is in a place where it can be seen from a great distance. It kind of leaves me with that impression, but maybe not. Verse 2, the Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes. There's going to be a long list of people here. The princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Now, your version may have different names there. It's the same people, whatever title they may give them in your Bible. But a bunch of folks. And I suspect this is a gathering of everybody that's on the government payroll. All right, you're in a position in the government, and on this particular day, your job is to set aside your daily duties and to go to the plain where this statue is fixing to be dedicated. Verse 3, then the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. They stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 4, then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that the time you hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Whoso falleth not down and worshipeth the same hour, be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. Now, someone has supposed or suggested, or maybe they is a little stronger than that, that this is a perpetually burning place where they cremate their dead. Now, perhaps that's the case. I don't know, but there is a fiery furnace that apparently is ready. Verse 7, therefore at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Well, let's stop with those seven verses and the four words or five words, or however it is, and also look at, is those words made an image of gold? Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, or had it made. When I read that, and knowing the context of last week's message and two or three events that are to come in the book of Daniel, it gives me the idea that Daniel might be just, or that Nebuchadnezzar might be just a little bit fickle. That he, and I don't know, I assume that all of the accounts that are given in the book of Daniel are in chronological order. That's not always the case in the Old Testament, but we'll assume that they are until we find out otherwise as we go through here. But last week in the sermon, we saw that at the end of the text there, that Nebuchadnezzar was praising Daniel's God. What a wonderful God that you have. And now, I don't know how much time later it is, maybe a week, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. We don't know. Or I don't know. But here he is, just got through praising Daniel's God, and now he's building an image to worship to some other god. We're going to see where he flips back and forth two or three more times in the days and weeks ahead. He's fickle, it seems. He can jump on a bandwagon with great excitement and great enthusiasm and jump off just as quick. Now, to Nebuchadnezzar's credit, he views worship different than we do. He views it differently than Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He views it differently than Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar is accustomed to worshiping multiple gods, or being exposed to that, being around that. And it's no big deal for Nebuchadnezzar and his subjects and the people who worship these multitude of deities. They worship none of them with the expectations that the Israelites have for worship of their God. Because the Israelite God, the one true God, is not in competition with other gods. He's not a peer of other gods. He shares his sovereignty with no one else. He shares his authority and his glory with no other presupposed gods. And most of the time, if not all of the time, those who worship these multitude of deities in reality worship none of them very much, to a very great depth. We see in the book of Acts how fickle people can be. I'm sure if you thought through your experiences in your life, you will can remember people or know people, or maybe you can look around behind you and find some, I don't know, that are fickle. The book of Acts, Paul goes on one of his missionary journeys, and he comes to a place, I think it's Lystra, I'm not sure, and he heals a man, I believe he was crippled. And the people saw this man that they knew to be crippled miraculously healed. And it says that they immediately try to take Paul and Silas and make them gods. They were going to call one of them Jupiter, one of them Mercury. Mercury and Jupiter have come to visit us. And they prepare to worship Paul and Silas. And Paul and Silas see what is going on. And the text says they rent their clothes and they tear their clothes and they say, no, stop. We're just men like you. And it goes on to say that certain Jews from other areas came into town and talked to the people. And then the people took stones and stoned Paul. How do you go from wanting to worship this guy to stoning him and putting him outside the town and leaving him for dead? That's a pretty drastic change of affections. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 14, the Apostle Paul gives us the duties of the leadership of the church is to perfect the saints, to bring the saints to maturity. And one of the reasons he says that that is the case is so that we will not be driven about by every wind of doctrine that comes along. We'll not be affected and affazed by everything that comes down the pike. So what does that matter? Why does it matter if someone's a little fickle? Let's think of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel is in a high place of authority in Babylon. I'm sure he knows enough about Nebuchadnezzar to know that Nebuchadnezzar can be a little bit fickle. Nebuchadnezzar can be this way today and that way tomorrow. How does that affect Daniel's relationship with Nebuchadnezzar? I don't know, but I'll tell you how it would affect me. If I was there, I would get up every day and analyze Nebuchadnezzar's mood. I would be cautious in his presence to see which direction he's going today. And it's that way with people. There are people who jump from job to job to job. They jump on, they get a job, and oh, it's a wonderful job, and things are going to be so rosy, and 3 months later you see them and they're working somewhere else. We see that in the church. People go from church to church to church, and there are definitely good reasons to change churches. But some people, it's a career. You know, they've done it all of their life. They'll go this place for 2 or 3 years, and the next thing you know, there's someone else for 2 or 3 years. There are people that we know, that I know, who are capable teachers, capable leaders. But you just know, wherever they land, they won't be there long. They won't be there long. And if the person who is very discerning will be cautious about placing those perhaps gifted people in positions of leadership. A person who will jump on a bandwagon very quickly and impulsively will jump off the same way. That seems to be the way Nebuchadnezzar is. Let's read the next verses, verses 8 to 12. So we've got Nebuchadnezzar's built the image. He's commanded all the government employees to come to that place at a certain time. We're going to dedicate this image, and then he gives them the scenario. Here's our agenda. When the music sounds, when the dulcimer plays, and all the flutes and all the other things, when they play, at that instant, that moment, you're to bow down and worship this image. Verse 8, wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. So the music is played, they bow down and worship. And now we find that not all of them bowed down. There's an issue here. They spake and said to the king, these Chaldeans said to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Kind of a standard hello, I think, isn't it? Verse 10, thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worship them, he shall cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. He names them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. So let's see what's happened here. The music sounded, everyone's supposed to bow down. Out of all the thousands of people, perhaps, who were there, apparently they all bowed down in worship except three. I bet they stood out like a sore thumb. They stood out like someone at a ball game who won't kneel during the national anthem. You see all these people kneeling except one or two guys, maybe. Except a multitude more would be the case there. They don't bow down. their peers, some of their peers, certain Chaldeans who were there, notice it. And they've got an axe to grind with these three guys anyway, right? So they go to the king, and they say, King, you made a decree that at the sound of the music that everyone should bow down and worship. But there are certain Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the words we want to focus in on are those four words. There are certain Jews. There are certain Jews. They're specific about who they're talking about. Now, I've got a couple of thoughts there. If Babylon and the government officials behave like any other government officials, politicians, whoever that I have been exposed to the last few years, it seems to me that some of these people are doing something a little shady to grease their own palms. There's a lot of stuff going on that everybody knows about that's in the know on their Capitol Hill. And I imagine the swamp is just as deep there as it is here. But these people who are trying to find fault seem not to care about that if it's present. Surely there's something else that they could focus on to get straightened out in the kingdom. But they are focused on one thing, and it's these three guys that are not worshiping the statue. Someone has said, and I think it is true, that one of the greatest compliments that the church can receive is the fact that she is hated. She is hated. All right? People don't hate something that does not threaten them. They don't hate things that have no value. You ever seen anyone on a crusade against the tooth fairy? There are a multitude of people in this world who would say being a Christian is just as phony as the tooth fairy. Show me the books written refuting the idea of a tooth fairy. Show me the laws passed that ban pillows from being put on a kid's bed on their birthday or whenever when they pull a tooth, I guess is what is the case, isn't it? Does anybody do that? No. Nobody messes with fighting the tooth fairy. We know the tooth fairy is not real. Well, if you know Christianity is not real, why bother? Why go against it? Why not just chuckle and move on? When I was in college, my freshman year, there was a guy there that, I guess I don't need to remember his name, I probably don't need to say it, but he was something wrong with this guy. I just remembered his name. First name was Robert, let's go with that. And he would go around campus doing these bizarre things. And after a while, you know, I was a freshman, and wow, that was kind of an eye-opening experience for me. I'd never seen a guy like this, being from Heber Springs. And there he was. We'd walk around campus, and there was an amphitheater on campus where events were held, et cetera, et cetera. And one day that was on a main sidewalk that people walked around the upper side of this, going to and from classes. I was going around there one day, and he was down on the stage pontificate about something, giving a speech about something. And I could hear him talking, and I don't remember what he was talking about. And there were some people down there, and there's a couple of guys down there who were listening. One of them raised his hand to ask the orator a question. He said, "Tell me, what do you think about photosynthesis?" I kind of, chuckled, and a lot of other people did too, I suppose. And I don't remember what he said. And that's the point. I don't remember what he said. And I doubt if any of the other people who were there that day, if I could find them, if I knew who they were, and you could ask them about that event, if they even remembered the event, I doubt if any of them remember his reply. Why? Because it was worthless. It was just nothing. People who say they are an atheist, people who say they do not believe in God, betray themselves by their attitude toward Christianity. They cannot let it go. They cannot ignore it. They have to fight it. They have to grit their teeth. They have to hate it. They can't just chuckle and nod their head and go. At some point, occasionally, maybe not very often, but occasionally it spews out with hatred. And they reveal that they really see value. It's not that they don't believe God. It's that they despise the God that they know exists. There will always be certain Jews. In the day in which we live, I'm no prophet, but it don't have to be a prophet to see this coming. Things will get bad. If things go in the United States, in the government, and in our national debt, and all these things the way people are wanting them to go, it's going to escalate even faster and faster, and someday this country economy is going to be ruined. And that is perhaps a judgment from God. God may not strike this person or that person or this person, but he may destroy a disobedient and an unloyal people through economic collapse. This will not be the first country in the world to see hyperinflation. You see Venezuela, Zimbabwe, Germany in World War II, and I could name several from World War II era, I think. But you see that. And somebody is going to have to be blamed. It's somebody's fault that this takes place. And whose do you think will be blamed for it? The same person that Nero, or group of people that Nero blamed in the early Roman Empire. Those Christians. The Christians will be those certain Jews. Expect it. Didn't Jesus say the servant will not be more than his master? If they hated me, they'll hate you. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If they lay stripes on my back, this is not in the Bible, they will lay stripes on your back. If they take all that someone has, they'll take all that you have. Those certain Jews. In our day, that's the Christian church. Let's go on. Verses 13 to 16. So they've told Nebuchadnezzar, those certain Jews, and he names them, tells them who they are, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do you not serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if you be ready that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. Now, let's stop right in the middle of that for a second. Do Do you think Nebuchadnezzar knows these three guys? Do you think he ever remembers that he's met them, or has he met them at all? I think it's likely. You remember when Daniel told the king the dream, and Nebuchadnezzar made place him in a high position? It said he interceded or asked for these three guys, that Nebuchadnezzar might could make use of them. They are in a position of influence in this nation. Now, I want you to remember something. These guys are not an underground society attempting to destroy the king. They are working and they are serving Nebuchadnezzar for the benefit of his kingdom. I don't know if I would do that. But on the other hand, I probably would never find myself in such a position. But they are behaving in such a way that they are looking out for Nebuchadnezzar's best interest. Nebuchadnezzar is not accustomed to that, probably. Nebuchadnezzar sees these guys. He knows their reputation. And he gives them another opportunity, probably because of it. They have frustrated him. They have irritated him. They have made him angry, this fickle king. And yet he is not so furious that he doesn't know who he's talking to. These are loyal employees. These are loyal, profitable people in my kingdom. He says, is this true, what I hear? What verse were we in? 15. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Boy, he's changed, hadn't he? Just got through saying last week, there's no God like their God. And now he's saying, I'm a little bit above your God. Who is your God that he can deliver you out of my hands? You're the ones who would not worship. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, verse 16, answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we're not careful to answer thee in this matter. Now the phrase I want us to look at here, and I'm reading this morning from the King James Version for a reason. It's because of this phrase. And here's our phrase for number three. Are not careful to answer you. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego says, Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer you. Now you'll see right under that statement that I've got written out the rendering of this phrase in other versions. First one is the New American Standard. It says, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. The NIV says, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. The New King James and the ESV says, we have no need to answer you in this matter. Now let's look at those things. And none of those things are just heresy or anything like that. But there's an idea there that they fail to capture. If you look at the New American Standard, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. What does that mean? It sounds like that these three guys are saying, hey, we don't have to tell you that. We don't need to answer you. You can ask us, though. We don't have to answer you in that regard. That could be what they're saying. I don't think so. But that phrase sort of sounds like that, gives you that idea. There are a lot of times, and this is a pet peeve of mine, that's why I'm pausing to hammer on it a little bit, but you have stuff, you have your own property, you have responsibilities that are yours, and people want to intrude upon things that are your responsibility or your stuff. And you say, no. And they say, why not? Sometimes, and I always make people mad when I do this, but the answer that I want to give is because I said no. I don't have to give you a reason for everything I do with my stuff. It's mine. People ask you, why can't I do this or why can't I do that with my stuff or with areas of my responsibility? It's none of their business. I don't know if Nebuchadnezzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are saying this to the king. I kind of doubt it. I don't think that's probably the case. But look at the next one. We do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. The NIV. Now, to me, this is a little weak because of this reason. Nebuchadnezzar did not ask them, why did you not bow down? That would be, their answer there would be defending themselves. He didn't ask them why they did not bow down. He just said, did you? Did you bow down? He doesn't care why. All he wants is to see their knees. The reason I like the King James Version on this particular phrase is because it says, we are not careful to answer you. Now, take out the word not for just a second. You read this this way, we are careful to answer you. What does that? What would that mean? It means we are watching our words, right? We're a little cautious. We know, we recognize who we're talking to. And we're a little cautious. We're careful how we answer you in this matter. That's what that would mean. Now stick the word not in there. We are not careful. The idea is not that they're smart, Alex. The idea is this. We don't have to think about this. We don't have to go home and sleep on it tonight. We don't have to discuss it among ourselves. This is cut and dry. We know the answer. It was said, Martin Luther, that when he was called to give an answer before the Roman Catholic Church authorities back in the 1500s or whenever it was, on his way there, and if you were with us in the Holiness of God study, you remember R.C. talking about part of this event. But on the way there, this is supposedly a quote from Martin Luther talking to someone on his way to appear before King Charles V in the Roman Church. He said, my cause shall be commended to the Lord, for he lives and reigns who preserved the three children in the furnace of the Babylon king. If he is unwilling to preserve me, my life is a small thing compared with Christ. And listen to the rest. Expect anything of me except flight or recantation. I will not flee, much less recant. So may the Lord Jesus strengthen me. This is on his way there. But when he was there, and it came to the moment where Martin Luther had to give an answer, they said, will you recant? He said, will you give me 24 hours to think about it? I don't think Martin Luther was getting cold feet. I don't think so. I think he realized the gravity of this moment in his own life. And he wanted one more time to make sure of what he was doing. Here's three Hebrew children who refused to bow down, and now they're given a second chance. They could have said, Nebuchadnezzar's been good to us. We owe him this one little small thing. They could have said, it's useless to resist. If we resist, we're going to die. They could have said, God has providentially placed us in this position at this time. Why throw that all away? Think of the good that we can do where we are at. They could have said, and I've thought of this one, I've imagined things going on in my own life, you know, that of course have never transpired yet. But they could have said, this image is nothing. God knows I don't mean this. I'm just doing it. God knows I'm not serious. They could have said that. They could have said, we're in a pagan nation, and this is just their custom. You know, when you're in Rome, you do this to the Romans, et cetera, et cetera. I think they did. That probably was written later, you know. But they could have said something like that. They could have said, this is just a one-time thing. It's probably going to take a minute, you know, 2 minutes at the most. You know, what does that matter in the scheme of 30 years of my life? They could have said, we can do more good for the king by being alive and in our position than we can by dying. They could have said, and this might be my line too, that this is a horrible way to die. This is just asking too much. They could have said any of those things. And for the most part, their peers would have understood. Let me ask you a question. See it on the outline. What are some modern images of gold that you cannot bow down to? What are some modern images of gold that our church cannot bow down to? When we started videoing our sermons, we've always had CDs. You could get our sermon on the CD, and now it's on a video on YouTube. You can go to YouTube, Foothills Bible Church, Quitman, Arkansas. Make sure you put Quitman, Arkansas on there. You can see 10 or 15 or 20, I don't know how many's on there now, services that we've had. So can the world. When we first started doing this, Brian McDaniel told us one day in the elder board meeting, I think, he said, are y'all sure you've thought through what we're doing? Do we know what we're doing? What if the day comes when we are required to refrain from speaking out against abortion? Is that an image of gold that we cannot bow to? What about the idea and the sinfulness, the biblical teaching about homosexuality? Is that an image of gold that we cannot bow down to? I got a newsletter from Answers in Genesis this past week. Some of you may have got it. One of their speakers was in Bentonville, Arkansas, at Grace Point Church, and mentioned the relevance of creation and the effects that making light or the denial of creation and of God's rule over the world has had in the results, and mentioned homosexuality as one of them. The next Sunday, the pastor apologized to his church. In fact, he got asked to alter his words during the second service. What about critical race theory? Y'all up on that? I know the three words. I'm not up on it, but I have a feeling I'm again it. All right? But what if we're required to be certified that we understand how to deal with critical race theory? What if we are required, expected, to support BLM or Antifa? What if they want to have one of their peaceful protests right here? What if we have to acknowledge and understand the new and latest list of hate crimes that someone comes out with? Are any of these images of gold that we cannot bow down to, that will affect us? The next question is what will the fiery furnace look like to us? These three guys are facing a fiery furnace. Their life's going to be snuffed out just in a few minutes, or so they expect or threatened with. What will our fiery furnace look like? Will we be fined? $1,000, $10,000, wouldn't take many of them to finish us off, would it? Will we lose our tax-exempt status? I don't think that'd bother us a lick. Okay. Will Senior Pastor McCarty have to go to jail? You know, they're going to be coming after the senior pastor. I'll have to go to jail. And he's now got that title. From now on, anybody ask you who your senior pastor, there he is. Will every person in here be required to register with the state in some way? Hear me out. I don't know of anybody here that I could point to you so quickly and say, that person there will not stand. It may be me. But if we think rationally and push comes to shove and someone is faced with either yielding to the demands of the state or being hauled off to jail or this or that, it's very likely that somebody sitting in this room right now will say to themselves, this is not what I signed up for. This is too much. They are here. They enjoy our fellowship. They enjoy our friendship. We have great, intimate times together with one another. They have tasted the fruits of God's Spirit in our lives, and they like it. But when push comes to shove, they will cling to their 30 pieces of silver and slither off into the night, hoping no one notices. I've got a wife. If the threat against me was to harm my wife, what would I do? Some of you have young kids. If they were threatened, you say, well, no, they're going to threaten us to chop my little young kid's head off. No, you heard of foster homes. You're not a fit parent for whatever reason, this or that. We'll take them from you. I've heard that suggested that Christians kids need to be taken from them. They ought not be allowed to raise them in such a way. Have you not heard those lines out of idiots' mouths? We're not that far away from that kind of stuff. Some of you may be old. I'm 63. My first 63 years, I've never been persecuted. Not really. Maybe made fun of a little bit, embarrassed a little bit, this or that. Not nothing like this. Some of you may be 13. Some of you may be 93. I don't know. Maybe you're too old, too feeble, you think. I just couldn't make it. I couldn't bear it. What will our fiery furnace be? What are some things about which you are not careful to answer? You know the answer now. You know if this issue becomes required of me, the line is drawn. I will not do this. Now, all my life I've heard preachers bluster and puff their chest out and say what they're going to do, what they're not going to do. I'm not there. I don't intend to yield in certain things. But unless God gives us the grace to withstand, you don't know where you are. Let's look at the last one, verses 17 and 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, tell Nebuchadnezzar, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor worship the golden image which you have set up. Three words I want you to notice, those three words, but if not. These guys make three statements in these verses. First statement is this: God is able to deliver us. The second statement is this: God will deliver us. The third statement is, but if not, we still will not bow down to the image. A couple weeks ago, I think it was, I kind of got sidetracked on the positive thinking crowd and the prosperity type thinking a little bit, and I have to do it a little bit again just for a moment here. There are people in that crowd who would take issue with this third statement that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say. They like the first one, God is able to deliver us. They like the second one, God will deliver us. But when they say, but if not, they say, no, no, no. Don't make such comments like that. You're defeating the whatever it is that you're defeating. You're saying something wrong, and God may not or will not answer your request if you say something like that. But if not, we still won't. I'm going to give you two or three statements here. You can mull these over a little bit. First one is this, that faith is not defined or verified by results. Think on it. Faith is not defined or verified by results. The second one is this, that my faith in God is not seen as great because God delivers. Let me just give you an example of that, of the way I think. Here's two people, two guys standing here. They both, and maybe they can't see each other, I don't know how to make the example, but this guy is threatened, if you don't renounce God, we're going to kill you. And he says, I'm a believer. And they said, in Jesus Christ, if you don't denounce him, we're going to kill you. And suddenly, the lightning strikes and all this stuff goes on. And these people who are going to kill him are vaporized to who knows where. They're gone. They are killed. They're wiped out. It's over. And we look at that guy and we say, man, he had faith. Is that what you would say? I would. I would say, God is great. There's a big God out there who's watching over this guy. Now here's this guy, and he's got the same problem. If you don't recant your belief in God, we're going to kill you. We're going to cut your toes off one at a time, and then your feet, and then your arms until you renounce your faith in Jesus Christ. He says, I'm not doing it. They begin to whack away. And eventually he dies. I look at that. Here's what I think. That guy might have been wrong, but he believed in what he believed in. He had faith in the object of his faith, which was Jesus Christ. My faith, it's not seen as a great faith. You have such great faith because of the great things God performs on my behalf. No. This next phrase you need to think about. My faith in God is seen as I live in harmony with who God is. I live my life in such a way that it corresponds correctly with God and his nature. If you got your Bibles, turn to Hebrews chapter 11. I know you probably know what I'm fixing to say. Hebrews 11 is known as what? The faith chapter. What did someone else say there? The Hall of Faith. Okay. It's a chapter that gives us example after example of what real faith looked like and the results of real faith, et cetera, et cetera. He talks about Abel. He talks about Enoch. He talks about Noah by faith built the ark, et cetera. He goes on Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, Moses. Goes on over. You get on over to 30, verse 32. And what shall I more say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Barak and of Samson and of Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets. And he gives a big list of things that happened because of their faith. Subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, probably Daniel in view there, right? Quenched the violence of fire, probably Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, perhaps there. Escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Stop. Right in the middle of verse 35, two words. And others. And others were tortured, not accepting deliverance. This sounds different, doesn't it? That they might obtain a better resurrection. And others, verse 36, had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings. Moreover, of bonds and imprisonments. 37, they were stoned. They were sawn asunder. They were tempted where they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented. Now you got two groups of people here who are separated by these two words, and others. What is the difference between the first group, first 35 verses of Hebrews 11, and the next four or five verses after that? What's the difference between those two groups? Let me tell you what it's not. It's not their faith. The difference is not their faith. Verse 38, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves. Notice this next verse. And these all, both groups, all of the ones we have mentioned, having obtained a good report through what? Faith. Faith. Can God deliver us from persecution? Yes, He can. Yes, He can. Listen, if my faith in God depends upon my air conditioning working at home, if my faith in God depends on Him giving me a 40,000 square foot house for my faith to be valid, if my faith in God is only validated by a private jet or all of these things, then let me tell you, the object of my faith is that jet. Unless I get it, I'm disappointed in God. The object of my faith ought to be a God who is omnipotent, a God who is just and true and righteous altogether. A God who knows all things. A God who is full of mercy and truth. And when I look at that God, and He is the object of my faith, it matters not which side of that I'm on. If I live, I live. If I die, I die. But I am delivered from the King's hand. Either way. Right? God can deliver us. He will deliver us. Maybe not this week. He will deliver us. If He doesn't deliver us from the immediate fiery furnace, He will deliver us. He is still my Lord. Amen. I'm 63. I told you that a while ago, didn't I? I'm still 63. I used to make a joke with some of you I've quit making this joke with. But instead of giving you your age in years, I kind of calculate it as to the average lifespan of a person. And average lifespan is 80 years old, then if you're 60, 75% of your life is gone, right? So in joking, you know, I say, you ain't got 10% of your life left. You know, and I mean, that's a eye-opening way to look at yourself, isn't it? Most of my life is under the bridge. It's behind me. But I was born February 27th, 1958, for a reason. You were born when you were born for a reason. Your parents are who your parents are for a reason. God knows it all. God has a reason for it all. We live in this day, in this time, for a reason. And whatever we may face, whatever evil may come our way, God's grace is great. There was a lady who wrote a song. I want to think her name was Mary Johnson, but I may be wrong about that. But she lived her life in pain, crippling pain of some sort. And she wrote this song that some of you may know, and I'm not going to remember all the words, just a few words, but it goes, when we reach the end of all of our resources, we've done all that we can do to alleviate the difficult circumstances that we are in. There's nothing else we can do. Words go like this: God's giving has only begun. He giveth more grace. When the burdens get greater, He giveth more strength when the labors increase. I'm missing a line in there somewhere, but it goes to the end and says, He giveth and giveth and giveth. Again, someday we may hear the sound of the dulcimer. Someday we may hear the sound of the harp or the cornet or the flute. God, give us strength in those days. Amen. Let's pray. God, only You know what our lives hold. God, help us to love You. Give us a love for You. Give us the courage and the knowledge of who You are that cannot be shaken. God, we do not have this ability of ourselves. We don't. Glorify Your name and Yourself through our lives, whether it's in victories, in great things, or in suffering. Amen.